This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 2nd, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ada Bogado. Coming up in today's newscast, the U.S. Supreme Court refuses immediate review of Guantanamo detainee cases. In the biggest deal since NAFTA, South Korea agrees to trade agreements with the U.S. And the Chilean Navy continues to refuse responsibility for detention and torture aboard their fleet of ships during the 1973 coup. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Supreme Court today issued rulings in two major cases involving greenhouse gas and power plant emissions. In what some analysts call the most important environmental ruling in years, the court voted 5-4 that the federal government does have the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. The Bush administration had long claimed the Clean Air Act did not give the EPA authority to regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. In a second court ruling dating back to the Clinton administration, the court ruled unanimously against Duke Energy. The decision overturned a lower court's ruling. The power company now needs a permit from the EPA for emissions from coal-burning power plants. In other news from Washington, D.C., Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin introduced legislation to tie funding for the war in Iraq to a withdrawal date of March 31, 2008. It will require the Pentagon to start a pullout 4 months after the legislation takes effect. The language is similar to that of the $123 billion war supplemental that the president has vowed to veto, but it goes further. This is the first time congressional leadership has tied war funding to a timeline for troop withdrawal. Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi joined a bipartisan delegation of U.S. lawmakers in Lebanon today as part of a larger fact-finding tour of the region. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
Pelosi's visit comes as the Lebanese government is deadlocked in a battle between a pro-U.S. government and opposition forces, who have been encamped in downtown Beirut for the last 4 months in a bid to gain more representation. Pelosi met with members of both political camps and pledged U.S. support for the formation of a United Nations tribunal to try suspects in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Hariri's assassination led to an expelling of Syrian forces that had been in Lebanon for over 15 years. The U.S. Speaker of the House also met yesterday with Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. She called for the release of two soldiers captured by Lebanon's main opposition group, Hezbollah, last July. The incidents marked a 34-day Israeli military offensive against Lebanon that killed 1,200 civilians and effectively destroyed Lebanon's infrastructure. Meanwhile, Pelosi's bipartisan fact-finding tour is due to stop in Syria on Wednesday in a bid to gain Syria's help in solving the political crisis in Lebanon and in an attempt to woo Syria away from its alliance with Iran. Meanwhile, the White House has soundly condemned Pelosi's visit, accusing her of bolstering Syria's role in the region. Pelosi denied such accusations, saying it's a good idea to establish the facts and to build some confidence between the two countries. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
In Sri Lanka, 16 people were killed and another 28 were wounded in a bomb blast on a bus today in the rest of East near an army checkpoint. Pania Monikavasagam reports.
Police officials said the blast occurred when the passengers were getting off a crowded bus to be checked by troops manning a roadblock near the eastern town of Wampara. Three children, a woman soldier, and two off-duty police constables were among the dead. The government accused the Tamil Tiger rebels for the attack. The rebels denied the charge. The bomb attack came as President Mahinda Rajapaksa visited neighboring India to attend a two-day South Asian summit opening in New Delhi tomorrow. Sri Lanka is to discuss the threat of terrorism at the summit. In continuing violence on Sunday night, six civilians were shot dead by unidentified gunmen in the east. In another incident, eight civilians were killed in a barrage of artillery fire near Ampara. The military and the rebels blamed each other for the massacre. The latest attacks come amid the daily air raids, land and sea battles, ambushes and arbitrary killings and abductions in the northeastern region of the island. More than 4,000 people have been killed in the past 15 months after Mahinda Rajapaksa assumed the presidency. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
At least 13 people are dead after an 8.0 magnitude earthquake sent a tsunami crashing towards the Solomon Islands today. Authorities in the Solomon Islands have declared a state of emergency as rescue teams assess the damage. A Texas teenager sentenced to 7 years in juvenile detention for pushing a teacher's aide has been released from prison. Her case is one of many under review in the troubled Texas Youth Commission. From Houston, Renee Feltz has more.
Shaquanda Cotton was a 14-year-old student with no criminal record when a judge sentenced her to an indeterminate stay in juvenile detention for pushing a teacher's aide. Just months before, the same judge sentenced an Anglo-American teen to probation for burning down her family's estate. Outrage over the disparity in sentences grew when a sexual abuse scandal in the Texas Youth Commission exposed how staff threatened to extend the sentences of youth who spoke out against abuse. Over the weekend, a new official in charge of reforming the system ordered Cotton's release. She'd spent more than a year behind bars and had her stay extended by commission staff for minor infractions, like having an extra pair of socks. A special review panel will examine more than 1,500 other cases to determine if the sentences of youth eligible for release were improperly extended. As many as 400 other teenage prisoners could be released by the end of this week. Cotton will be on a 60-day probation. She says she won't return to school, but will pursue a GED from home. In Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the cases of detainees who want to challenge their 5-year-long detention at Guantanamo Bay. This is a victory for the Bush administration, which has tried only one of more than 300 detainees, but wants to keep the detention center open. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Three justices, Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg, said this case should be heard immediately because so many clarifications need to be made. But they weren't in the majority. Agreeing with the majority of the court, Justices Stevens and Kennedy said it's too early for the court to decide on whether U.S.-held detainees should have access to habeas corpus. That's the right to challenge their detention. Instead, the court should wait and see how the law handles detainees' judicial review, they say. The Detainee Treatment Act, which passed in 2005, replaces the right to challenge with a narrow judicial review process, providing detainees with fewer rights.
That review is useless.
Wells Dixon is an attorney for the detainees. Dixon says several cases trying to challenge their detention in an alternative review process are being stalled.
And what the Supreme Court said, unfortunately, was that we now have to wait and that everyone has to at least jump through the hoops has to go through the motions of seeking review.
Trying to confirm their concern on the issue, Justices Stevens and Kennedy wrote that the government should not unreasonably delay proceedings, and if they continue to do so, they could possibly hear the case later. But praising the court's decision, the U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement wrote that there is no need for the court to assess the adequacy of the review before the review has even taken place. This is the first major win for the Bush administration on Guantanamo Bay in the Supreme Court. The court twice ruled that detainees were not given enough rights. The Bush administration made minor changes to appease those rulings. But those changes don't please the critics. Attorney Thomas Sullivan represents 12 detainees.
My reaction is somewhere between disappointed and astounded at the ruling that continues the incarceration of these people without having any hearings come anywhere near what we would consider a due process of law, and to say that they're remitted to their rights under the Detainee Treatment Act, I find, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be laughable.
385 detainees remain at Guantanamo Bay. Less than 10 are charged with any crime, and only one has been tried in 5 years. As for the remaining 300...
The prisoners are just sitting in small, tiny cages without any access to reading material or proper food or medical attention. They've been sitting there for 5 years, separated from their families. They've never had a hearing as to why they're being held there. And I think it's a national disgrace.
This ruling could provide the momentum Congress has been looking for to reinstate detainee rights. In a statement, Senator Christopher Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut and presidential candidate, said the Supreme Court's decision is regrettable. He said it's reason enough for Congress to act and restore judicial review. The House held a hearing on detainee rights last week. The Senate is expected to follow suit. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Negotiators in Seoul reached an agreement today that could start free trade between the United States and South Korea. If the deal wins congressional approval, it will be the most significant free trade agreement since NAFTA began in 1994. The deal was made just in time for the Bush administration to present Congress with a fast-track trade bill. From Seoul, FSRN's Jason Strother reports.
Kim Eun-kyun has been selling vegetables and fruits at a small alley market in Seoul for 20 years. She picks through the piles of cabbage, onions, and garlic, all grown on Korean farms. She says she's worried about her country's farmers.
I think there will be so many cheap American imports. In Korea, there aren't enough farmers. That's why they don't like the free trade agreement.
The talks were supposed to wrap up on Friday, but two extensions dragged out the final round over the weekend. It concluded just minutes before the final deadline on Monday. Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Karan Bhatia announced the conclusion of negotiations Monday afternoon.
The negotiations that led to this FTA demonstrate that two countries with large, complex, and dynamic economies and a tradition of robust public involvement can work through challenges and craft a high-quality free trade agreement.
President Bush needed to strike an agreement by today in order to utilize fast-track trade passage, which requires a 90-day congressional review for a yes or no vote on a bill without the option of amendment. His authority to use this tactic expires on July 1st. The deal lowers tariffs and other trade barriers in many sectors, especially for automobiles. It does open parts of Korea's agricultural industry, but includes provisions that will protect farmers from an overabundance of American goods. Korea's rice market, a major sticking point throughout the talks, was in the end excluded from the agreement. Kim Chi-young is with the Korean Alliance Against the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. He acknowledges that both sides made many concessions, but hopes that it won't be approved by either nation.
I think this is one of the most tragic and one of the worst trade relations treaty that has happened in a long time. You know, having not given up rice doesn't make this any better. Already in finance and also in pharmaceuticals and in textiles industry, the U.S. has basically gotten whatever it wanted.
The negotiations had been overshadowed by massive demonstrations, like this one back in January, that saw tens of thousands of Koreans take to the streets to condemn free trade. Some rallies turned violent, and riot police have forcibly dispersed crowds. On the eve of the trade deal, an activist in the capital set himself on fire in protest, but was not critically injured. Farmers, students, and labor unions fear that Korea will suffer the same hardships as Mexican farmers since the start of NAFTA. Speaking to reporters at today's press conference, America's top negotiator, Wendy Cutler, says today's breakthrough is good for both Korea and the U.S.
I think it's a high-quality agreement, yet it's extremely balanced. It includes state-of-the-art chapters in intellectual property protection, e-commerce, competition policy. It includes strong protections for the environment and labor, and it includes tremendous achievements with respect to market access.
If approved by Korean and American lawmakers, it could increase trade between the two nations by $20 billion. Back at the market, grocer Kim Eun-kyung is wrapping up some strawberries for a customer. She agrees that Korean farm goods are expensive and that she will sell American produce if an FTA does get approved, but she says she doesn't want Korean farmers to suffer.
The Korean farmers say that they're going to die, and I am a Korean, so I have to support them.
Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, South Korea, I'm Jason Strother.
Since the invasion of Iraq 4 years ago, most basic services have faltered. Across the country, electricity is on for fewer hours each day, and broken water and sewage systems are not getting repaired. The food rations that sustained many Iraqis under United Nations sanctions are also harder to get, and some Iraqis accuse the Shia-led government of turning a blind eye to the suffering of Sunni citizens. Hiba Dawood reports on how continuing sectarian violence has left Sunni neighborhoods deprived of government services.
In Shiite areas of Baghdad, the distribution of essentials like gasoline and the government food rations is carried out by Shiite militias. Ahmed Abdullah, 24, is a self-described member of the Jaish al-Mahdi from Sadr City.
The Mehdi army is a group of people who organize and assist the people of Sadr City when they are in need. They provide gasoline and cooking oil to the people, as well as other services like cleaning the street, and they don't take anything back as payment.
The Jaish al-Mahdi is probably Iraq's largest militia, and nominally loyal to anti-occupation cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The Mehdi army has a strong presence in the dense neighborhood of Sadr City, named for Muqtada's father. In Sunni neighborhoods, there is no such basic items. Residents also complain that in comparison to Shiite neighborhoods, their supply of water and electricity is neglected. Al-Sadr representatives in the government control many key ministries, including health, electricity, and transportation. Jinan Obeidi, a member of rival Shiite parties that has a clash with Sadr supporters, acknowledges the difference.
In Sunni neighborhoods, people can't go to get the food ration. It is risky for the Sunnis who live there, as well as the Shiite. Though I would say that there are no more mixed areas. They are either Sunni or Shiite. It is true that people in Sunni areas can't get the services or security as much as the Shiites do.
Baby formula, flour, and cooking oil are some of the most critical rations for families. When people do not receive these items, they may sell a piece of furniture to buy food on the black market, which in turn raises its prices when there is shortage in government food rations. Dafer Al-Ani is a member of the Tawafiq Front, an alliance of conservative Sunni politicians that has 44 seats in the country's parliament.
The idea of the Mehdi army being able to provide humanitarian aid to the people of Sadr City reflects how the militias infiltrate the state systems. There is a sectarian discrimination policy in the government system.
Al-Ani says Sunni neighborhoods have the double problem of dealing with sectarian violence as well as facing greater hostility from U.S. troops. In response, militias target anyone employed by the government, including street sweepers, as potential spies. Mohammed, who asked that we not use his last name, is a reporter living in Ghazaliya, a mostly Sunni area.
It is the Sunni fighters who are killing the municipality workers. I don't know why, but it has become a phenomenon. Not only accidents happening in Sunni areas like Ameria and Dora. I have the impression that they think they are spies. I mean, definitely, some of the spies are Mehdi army or other Shiite groups. That is why the government doesn't care that much about the Sunni areas.
The net effect is to distance civilians from the government, and the continued disenfranchisement does little to increase hopes of sectarian reapproachment. It was also reported this weekend that Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the ranking Shiite cleric in Iraq, rejected a new law to essentially pardon members of the former government. One of the chief demands of many insurgent groups is that previous Ba'ath Party membership to be decriminalized. I'm Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
The Chilean Navy's training vessel, the Esmeralda, is one of the world's largest sailing ships, and each year leaves its home port of Valparaiso with a new crew of sailors. Also known as the White Lady, the Esmeralda has a notorious past. As FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports, the ship served as a detention and torture center following Chile's 1973 military coup.
With its sails in full view, the four-mast Chilean training vessel left this Sunday for yet another training mission, with midshipmen hoping to become officers in Chile's Navy. The ship was escorted out to sea by a small flotilla of sailboats. The hourly happy scene was confronted by a small group of demonstrators from Amnesty International and friends of Michael Woodward. a British priest who died as a victim of torture aboard the Esmeralda days after the 1973 military coup. Patricia Woodward is the priest's sister.
Every time that the Esmeralda goes on a cruise, we work towards getting people to demonstrate against the ship, not against the crews of the ship, but about the Navy as an institution, because it was responsible for the death of my brother and the torture of 110 victims on the Esmeralda alone.
The ship, along with all the ships in the Navy port of Valparaíso, were used as detention centers, where supporters of the deposed socialist government of Salvador Allende were detained and tortured. Now the Esmeralda is met with protesters who remind the Navy of its present-day responsibility to account for past incidents of torture, murder, and human rights violations. Chile's Navy does not acknowledge that the Esmeralda was a floating detention and torture center sanctioned by the Navy, but rather organized by individual officers. Elena Stevens of Amnesty International explains what their demonstration with the Woodward family hopes to achieve.
We are here demanding the government and Navy admit that there was a torture center here in Valparaíso, not only on the Esmeralda, but also other detention centers. We demand these cases be impartially investigated by the courts, that the guilty be brought to justice and reparations made to the victims and their families. That is our demand. We are also finishing a signature collection campaign that we began in 2003. In support of the four-point demand that we are presenting the Navy Admiralty.
The Esmeralda will sail for 8 months in the South Pacific and Asia, visiting New Zealand, Australia, China, and Japan, among other ports. It is expected it will be met with demonstrators in New Zealand and Australia. The victims and their families say the demonstrations will continue until justice is served and reparations are made. Only then, they say, can the image of the Esmeralda be cleansed. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garreton in Valparaíso.
As countries around the globe celebrate World Health Week, some groups are questioning why the United States, one of the wealthy nations in the world, still lags behind in key healthcare issues. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Unlike in other countries, where lack of health care might be due to fewer health care providers, in the U.S., a lack of quality care is more often due to a lack of access to providers. Meredith Dobson, Director of Domestic Campaigns for Results, a grassroots organization that works on health care issues.
In terms of how much money we spend on healthcare, the United States ranks pretty high, but what we're actually getting for the money that we spend as consumers is a whole different story. Our healthcare costs are going up dramatically, yet there are over 46 million Americans who don't have health insurance. That includes 9 million children, and then millions more are underinsured, which means that they don't have the kind of adequate and quality coverage that they need.
Today, President Bush participated in a White House meeting to discuss health savings accounts. The accounts are designed to help individuals save for medical expenses on a tax-free basis. Likewise, recent legislation has been proposed for universal health care. Healthcare accounts and universal health care coverage are all a part of a growing list of programs that Americans are juggling to try to get the coverage that they need. According to annual reports released by the Department of Health and Human Services, there are still many deficiencies in providing overall quality care in preventable illnesses that many Americans suffer from, such as obesity, diabetes, and asthma. Jeff Brady is a medical officer who helped write both reports. As Brady explains, the doctor-patient relationship was a critical part of care for those surveyed.
There's one within the segment of patient-centeredness, and it asks about adults whose healthcare providers always listened carefully, explained things clearly, and showed respect for what they had to say and spent enough time with them.
As in previous years, the reports show disparities between racial, ethnic, and economic groups. with blacks receiving poorer quality care than whites, Hispanics receiving poorer quality than non-Hispanic whites, and poor people receiving lower quality of care than those with high incomes. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Women's reproductive health care suffered a major blow after the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last month that Union Pacific Railroad's exclusion of birth control from employee health plans does not constitute discrimination. Lalani Albano reports.
The decision by the three-judge panel sent shockwaves throughout the nation. Miriam Girace is Communications Director for Planned Parenthood, Los Angeles.
We believe the Eighth Circuit ruling is a step backward for women's health.
The verdict overturns a 2005 judgment that Union Pacific, the nation's largest railroad company, illegally discriminated against women when it refused to provide contraceptive coverage to 1,300 of its female workers. In the decision, which was handed down on March 16, the judges reasoned that the railroad company's birth control policy is no less favorable to women because it does not cover men's condoms or vasectomies. Loretta Ross, who is the national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Health Collaborative, calls the ruling pregnancy discrimination.
They tried to do this really bizarre thing by saying, well, since men are not requiring contraceptive coverage and we're not paying for that, then we don't have to pay it for women. But, of course, men don't get pregnant. And it's kind of like saying, well, men don't get breast cancer, so we won't cover breast cancer because women get it.
Although Union Pacific does not cover birth control, the company covers non-contraceptive prescriptions for male employees, including Viagra and Rogaine, a popular men's hair growth product. Organizers say accessible birth control is central to women's health and can have a positive impact on the well-being of families. Again, Miriam Girace.
When women and their families have the opportunity to space the number of children that they have or to plan when and whether to have kids, they can also prepare for their education, they can consider where to live. There's all kinds of opportunities that present themselves when you're not subject to the whims of biology.
Girace says that while California law requires that government workers receive birth control coverage in their health care plan, the ruling would allow some private employers to deny such coverage. An appalling decision, activists may agree, but not surprising. Rather, the decision is in line with the rising number of conservative attacks on birth control, including refusals by pharmacies nationwide to offer the morning after pill, known as Plan B. Says Ross.
It is so clearly a sign of the subordinate status of women in our society, why we need more women on these courts, and basically the distrust and disdain they have for women's needs.
The Union Pacific decision is binding in the courts in the seven states within the Eighth Circuit: Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota, and will therefore have far-reaching implications. To combat further assaults on birth control, Planned Parenthood is proposing a new measure, the Prevention First Act, which seeks to expand access to reproductive health care services and make it illegal to exclude birth control coverage in health plans. Again, Miriam Girace.
Men and women across the United States are saying, hold on a second, we need this kind of preventive care. Health access is in a shambles, and so we're going to take action on a federal level.
For FSRN, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ada Bogado.